Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for this very special discussion of Natural Born Killers by the biggest natural born killer I know, Mr. Adam Riske.
And at the end of the show, we're giving away some natural born kittens fresh out of the egg.
Oh, I fucked that up. Okay, so I'll cut my response. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. If this is your 200th time listening to the show, welcome back. You can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. Like our page on Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store. Leave a rating if you like the show. Listen to us on Stitcher, DVDverdictPresents.com.
We're pervasive.
Yeah, we're pretty, we're like cockroaches.
We're the
cockroaches
the
of podcasting.
Yeah.
We will be discussing Natural Born Killers from 1994 via Twitter request by Brian Kidd with two D's late in 2014. He said, hey, when 2015 starts, how about you guys do Natural Born Killers? And we said, sure. So we're going to be talking about that in a little bit. But Adam Riske,
yeah.
Have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I've seen quite a bit of things that were interesting, too good-ish,
right.
And some stuff that's not so good. But it's been a rough week to be a movie fan. So
what could you possibly be referring to?
I don't know. Oscar nominations.
Oh, right.
Yeah. The fact that the country's been taken over by legions of people who don't care about movies but all of a sudden care about them as a political agenda.
Yes, that is unfortunate.
Yeah, it's been rough. So but I want to, as much as we can, for a show about natural born killers, let's keep it light.
Let's keep it fun.
No need to be in the doldrums. You know, it's January, but it's sunny somewhere. It's not necessarily sunny here.
No, it's not too bad here.
No, it's 39 degrees. It's pretty fantastic.
It's balmy,
for Chicago.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Okay, so let's go into the rewind real quick. Let's talk about the films of August of 1994. We got Andre. We got Karina Karina.
Holy shit.
We got In the Army Now.
Wow.
Milk Money Dropped.
Natural Born Killers probably deserves some more respect.
Natural Born Killers was, if we did an F This Summer show for 1994, we'd be like, oh God, I've been so Andre'd out and Karina Karina this. And then Natural Born Killers would be like a big gulp in the Oasis.
Yeah.
It would be like an oasis in the desert.
Yeah.
So. So I would just want to talk about Andre.
All right. Tina Majorino and a seal.
Yeah.
I defy you to tell them apart.
I don't know. One sings Kiss from a Rose.
That's correct.
Yeah, I think it's Tina
Majorino. Majorino.
She's talented.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
on what, Black Hatter or something? Or she's on some show.
She was on Veronica
Orphan
Mars.
Orphan Black?
I don't think that's her.
God, what was it? She's on some...
She was on Veronica Mars.
She's on some, like, trendy show, and I don't know much about shows anymore. I still haven't watched True Detective. I need to watch that.
She's not on that. That's Matthew McConaughey.
Okay.
That's
she was in Dallas Buyers Club.
Correct.
Okay,
correct. She
gotcha.
Won an Oscar. A well-deserved Oscar.
She's the Duff. Can we not try to make the Duff happen?
What is that even? I haven't seen a trailer. I've only seen
the
poster.
I saw the trailer once.
That's what I call Hillary Duff. Not Haley.
Apparently,
I call Hillary Duff the Duff.
Apparently it's a thing in high schools now.
No, it's not.
The Duff is designated ugly fat friend.
Oh, no, that's not a thing.
Yeah.
At
so,
all.
But
good job, screenwriter.
I know. I made this joke in my Risky Business column, so I'm going to spoil it for you guys if you want to skip reading it this week. It's as if a screenwriter went into a coma in 1999, woke up out of it, and he's just like, how long have I been asleep for? 15 years? Hold on, I gotta capitalize off this MILF wave.
No, he cracked that code and made the Duff.
Yeah, so I went in a roundabout here. Let's get back to talking about the schmovies.
Got it.
All right, so Big Eyes came out at the end of last year.
It did, and we didn't talk about it because we're just catching up on all the stuff we didn't talk about during our best of run.
Yeah, and I think
the Big Eyes didn't get talked about in our best of series. Can
no,
you believe it?
No. But that's not to say it was a bad movie. I thought that it was Tim Burton's best movie in a while.
Sure.
Maybe since Sweeney Todd.
but that's handicapping it.
And, it is.
Because he hasn't really had a good match. I didn't think it was terrible.
I didn't think so either. I saw it with John and his lovely wife, Jan, and we had... Oh, God, you guys should have been there. It was like this great run of jokes after it was over, because it was on the weekend where the weekend weigh-in question was, which person would you like to be on for your dream commentary, which person would you like to have on a commentary? And I said the real-life character that Christoph Waltz played on the commentary for Big Eyes.
Right.
Because he'd be like, this is all lies. But no, I thought it was enjoyable. It was maybe a little bit too easy, I think, on Margaret Keane, but being that she's kind of the voice behind the property, she cut herself some slack because
she just didn't have a choice.
She
didn't have a choice.
Sure. That excuses you for years and years of lying and fraud. I thought Amy Adams it wasn't one of her best performances, but she was good. Yeah. Christoph Waltz it's tough to judge because he's super over the top, but maybe he's just playing that guy.
That's certainly part of the character.
Yeah.
But I do feel like he kind of does one thing. Mm-hmm. And when you place it in the right context, which would be anything Quentin Tarantino does, what he does is awesome.
Yeah.
And then when you take him out of that context, you're just like, oh, you just do the one thing over and over again.
Yeah, it was a little choppy.
And it was fine. I mean, he wasn't, again, my problem with the movie was that Tim Burton was like so determined to not make a Tim Burton movie that he just made a movie that felt like it could have been made by anyone. I just thought it had no personality. And it was written by the guys that did Ed Wood. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe the three of them teaming up to do another biopic. I was like, oh, cool.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was kind of a mess. Super watchable just for I liked all the period recreations of California at that time. And like all that stuff was cool. And the performances were fine to good, you know.
If you like period recreations, there's a scene in Movie 43 with Chloe Grace Moretz that you might like.
I do. That's one of my favorite period recreations. Was that the one that's directed by Elizabeth Banks? That sequence.
Was it?
I believe that's what got her Pitch Perfect 2.
Oh, my God. I haven't seen Pitch Perfect 1.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
I see everything in the fact that I haven't seen Pitch Perfect 1. I don't ever claim like a badge of honor for not watching something, but I just feel very confident in my decision to have never watched Pitch Perfect.
Sure. People love it, and that's fine. I hate all of the marketing that just replaces the word bitch with pitch, or like puts AKA in front of anything for that matter.
Well then, sir, you are the Duff of our group.
So Big Eyes is fine. Like we get to a sequence halfway through where all of a sudden she's walking through a supermarket and they're playing a very contemporary Lana Del Rey song. And I couldn't figure out, what is this movie? Where does this scene come from?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I tune out anytime I hear Lana Del Rey. Yeah. I immediately go to some happy place where I can avoid the Lana Del Rey song.
I forgot it literally on the drive home. I forgot the movie. Like it really disappeared from my memory very quickly.
Yeah, it's not super memorable, and it's almost out of theaters now. I think it deserved a fate better than it got, but at the same time, it's hard to get too worked up about a movie I don't know. It's
like inoffensive,
it is what it is.
Right?
Yeah,
but that's kind of it.
It's kind of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to avoid bringing up American Sniper, but I saw American Sniper. I liked it more than you did. I think it's okay, but it's just become in the span of like the Thursday night that I saw it.
Yeah.
I saw it Thursday night. From that time to today, it's become like more than a movie all of a sudden.
Yep.
And it's a combination of like all the Oscar nominations, and then like it's become this Republican platform movie and everything. And I saw that you sent out a tweet where and I completely agree with you. It's just, let's just talk about it as a movie. Let's not put all this background, you know, where you come from, what your ideologies are around it. And as a movie, I described it to you in a previous conversation. It's like if Clint Eastwood had a marathon session one afternoon of playing Call of Duty and then going to Old Country Buffet. Like, it's just the most detached war sequences that you could really imagine.
Yeah.
followed by just really cursory elements of, you know, Sienna Miller at home with Bradley Cooper not really wanting to be at home all that much. And they spend maybe, I'd say collectively in the movie, say 30 minutes on that material, yeah. 30, 45 minutes on that material. It's covered better in 5 minutes in The Hurt Locker.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That sequence in the grocery store.
Yeah, where yeah. he just doesn't
unbelievable.
Want, where he just doesn't want to be there.
Right.
And the thing that
doesn't even know how to be there.
Exactly. And the thing that I don't get is people are judging this movie in the wrong context. You have to compare it to The Hurt Locker, compare it to Zero Dark Thirty, some modern day movies that have war and political elements to it. And it's so inferior to those two movies that I feel like that whole strand is getting lost in
right.
in the conversation. And I think Bradley Cooper is very good in it. He's more impressive because he's really got nothing to play.
Well, this is part of my problem with the movie is that I can't yeah. for the life of me figure out what the movie is about, except yeah. for like, okay, this guy who keeps going back to war and he's mm-hmm. a hero and blah, 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 blah. But I heard Bradley Cooper describe it as we really wanted, you know, not to do a pro or anti-war movie. We wanted to do a character study.
Yeah.
And I feel like on that level, the movie fails because I don't know anything about the guy
no.
except some of the things he did. Like in terms of his psychology, I don't understand him any better as a human from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is he went to war 4 times and shot a bunch of people.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wish that this material found a director who had more curiosity into the subject
yes.
and maybe more backbone about the subject, too. I read like in some trivia that one of the things that they were running up against Bradley Cooper and Clint Eastwood was like basically Chris Kyle's dad said that he would like kick their ass if they screwed up their his son's story. And by doing that and having just kind of a straightforward approach to it, you're not telling this guy's story.
Right.
And one problem that I have with a lot of biopics is it's not good enough just to tell a guy's story anymore. I think that you need to have some kind of opinion circulating about it, using that guy's story as to posit your theory about something or
right.
to posit your right. opinion about something.
Right.
This movie has really no opinion about anything. So it's
not about anything.
It's really, I don't know. I mean, I understand people wanting to go see it. I don't understand it getting basically this audience of people that don't normally go to movies all of a sudden feel like it's their civic duty to go see American Sniper.
Right.
It's really peculiar to me. I wish they would feel that same way about Selma.
A much better movie
with a lot on its mind. And
that is about way more than just telling us what happened.
Yeah. It's,
you know,
it's a movie full of feeling and full of just, I don't know. I really admire that movie.
Yeah.
And it makes me super sad that in the whole Best Picture category has become such bullshit since they've upped it from 5 nominations. It's just a bunch of like toss in nominations.
Well, as I've said before, no matter what, once we get down to a week or two out from the Oscars,
yeah.
it's still between 2 movies. You
mm-hmm.
can make it 5 movies. You can make it 10 movies. You can make it 50 movies.
Yep.
We're going to be saying, well, it's either this or this. It's either Boyhood or what now? Possibly American Sniper. I don't know if this movie's
yeah.
success is going to propel it to sort of the front of that particular race. It may, which is fascinating to me.
Right. Yeah. The thing that's just so confusing to me about it is if Clint Eastwood got this material in his Unforgiven Perfect World stage of his career, he would have made a much better movie out
yeah,
of this material. And what the fuck happened to him in the last 15 years that has made him so closed off compared to what he was before, where
yeah.
he was a very empathetic, sensitive type of filmmaker.
At least thoughtful.
Thoughtful, yeah,
you know,
that's a better word.
And that's the thing
yeah.
about American Sniper. It's not that it's thoughtless, it's just not thoughtful. It's like, it's not anything. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't get it.
It's peculiar. But
yeah.
And then I saw the number 2 movie of the weekend.
Yeah, you did.
My main man, Kevin Hart's joint, The Wedding Ringer. And you were right when we were talking about it beforehand. Kevin Hart and Josh Gad are not the problem in that
no.
movie, which is a shock to me because I am not. I used to be a Kevin Hart fan, but his crop of movies from last year really soured me.
His movies are terrible. Like his stand up can still be really funny.
Yeah.
But he tends to be in bad movies, and a lot of times is kind of annoying in them.
Yes.
And Josh Gad is often the most annoying thing in any movie he's in.
Mm-hmm.
So putting them together seems like cinematic kryptonite.
Yes.
And yet, are the best things about it.
Exactly. I laughed a few times.
Okay.
I didn't think that it was something... It wasn't at the level of, like, the lazy Adam Sandler comedies. I felt like it was at least trying to make you laugh. And
sure.
But the thing that I was shocked by was its completely hateful attitudes.
Yes.
with gay men and women.
Women in general,
are either...
The elderly.
Yeah, women are either evil or tramps,
right.
And the tramps are the good ones.
Right.
But if you're not a tramp, then you're
gold
evil.
Diggers or whores,
yeah.
Which I guess was sort of the same, but not exactly in this movie's eyes.
Yeah.
Dark, dark view of humanity. although I will say Olivia Thirlby comes out unscathed.
She does. Yeah. I almost wished her character wasn't in it so I could have like a clean line of sight to this argument against.
And you can't even say like, you can't even say that she's a positive portrayal of a woman in the movie.
She's just not horrible.
She's just not horrible because there's nothing particularly positive or admirable about her.
Mm-hmm.
Just she seems nice and not a monster and not a prostitute.
And she's just a likable screen presence.
I agree.
I've seen her in, like, I think I noticed this when I saw Dread. I just was like, I'm happier that Olivia Thirlby is in this movie than if she wasn't in this movie.
Yeah.
And, like, just her showing up kind of lends, I don't know, maybe some dignity to the wedding ringer.
Yeah.
At least in the very short scenes that she's in. But yeah, I mean, I didn't think it was way better than Ride Along, and it was better than About Last Night.
I still haven't seen About Last Night.
I don't know. But it's like eating spoiled fruit and like you get, you know, rock hard candy instead.
That's the thing. It's like, it's not a very funny movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I was fine watching it. It's just when you sit there and think about it that you realize its problems are very specific and unique to that film.
Yeah.
Even the fact that the director seems to carry everything on about three times longer than he should. So we find out that the two of them can dance, but then we have to see them do 15 different styles of dance together when two or three gets the point across. Or the football game that goes on for what feels like 10 minutes as old men just beat them up and swear and yell homophobic slurs.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious stuff. The theater I saw the movie with, all that stuff killed.
Yeah, same with mine. It was
when Josh Gad is singing that coconut song at the end. I mean, they went out on a huge laugh.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I had the same thing. I did think the coconut thing was funny the first time.
Oh my gosh.
But I don't know.
The only line I think I laughed at was Kevin, and I'm going to spoil the one laugh in The Wedding Ringer, was when Kevin Hart is rehearsing being Bic Mitchum for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean you don't have any candy? I'm Bic Mitchum and I want some candy, or something along those lines.
Okay.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
There's the biggest laugh in Wedding Ringer, everyone.
No, that was the biggest laugh in Ride Along also. The anticipatory laugh to come a year later.
That movie. What else?
And then I watched The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Yes.
Which I will have a review up some point this week. It's a... it's the Kickstarter movie that Spike Lee had in development. And I was always, ever since the debacle that was Wish I Was Here, I kind of have, you know, trepidation when it comes to these Kickstarter funded projects. And then I was at Ebert Fest last year and Spike Lee was there with Do the Right Thing. And after the movie, he did a post screening Q&A and somebody asked him what his Kickstarter movie was about, because he was being very vague.
It's a remake of Ganja and Hess, isn't it?
It is a remake of Ganja and Hess. Yeah. So he goes, and I'm trying to impersonate Spike Lee as best I can. He goes, "It's about the blood. Who's got it? Who needs it?" And then he didn't say anything else after that.
Perfect.
And
the guy, Spike, take my money.
And the guy stood up to ask his question, just stood there looking like somebody just shat on his foot
right.
And was like, "Okay, thanks." And then he sat down. So with that, I was kind of wary going into The Sweet Blood of Jesus. I'm a big fan of Spike Lee. I'll acknowledge his missteps, though,
sure,
which are many, especially in the second half of his career. This is probably my favorite of his movies since maybe Inside Man.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of Miracle at St. Anna. Red Hook Summer is half a good movie and then it implodes. Old Boy's Funny Curiosity, yeah, but that's about
barely
it.
Barely a Spike Lee movie.
This is definitely all Spike Lee. It's all him going for it. And it's funnier than I thought it would be. Okay. It's definitely a blaxploitation type of movie.
I'm in.
It would be perfect for Junesploitation.
All right.
It's something that I would say, you know, it's getting a VOD release and a very limited theatrical release, I think, next month. So I would say it'll probably be on DVD or some kind of streaming in June. I would earmark it for Junesploitation. It's kind of amateurishly acted, but it's always interesting, and I never knew where it was going. It's very musical. There's a lot of music in it, and a lot of the music is great. It's fantastic music. They made a point in the end credits of kind of pushing that these are unsigned artists, so he was kind of trying to get their careers rolling.
That's cool.
But there's like a musical sequence towards the end that's got like Rafael Sadiq from like Tony in there, and I'm a big fan of that kind of music, and that, I mean, it was a very enjoyable, interesting experience. It's a mess. I don't know what it's trying to say at all.
Okay, but, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Who's got the blood?
Because
I have a follow-up question.
Okay, that's a spoiler.
Who needs it?
It's about the blood. Who's got it? Who needs it? Spike Lee, I'm out.
I'm excited to check it out. I have not been able to this weekend, but I really want to.
Yeah, it's definitely, I would say, something that's worth watching.
Yeah.
Considering this has been like a big weekend for like heavy hitter directors kind of releasing their newest movies. And I would say of American Sniper, Sweet Blood of Jesus, and then Black Hat, this is probably my favorite of the three.
All right.
So, right, not great, but you know, definitely worth watching.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No. Oh, well, actually I'll just throw this one in real quick. I don't know how you feel about the movie Jarhead.
Haven't seen it since it came out.
So
I think I liked it at the time enough.
Yeah. So I watched it this afternoon just kind of I wanted to detox from American Sniper a little bit. And then I also felt like watching something with Gyllenhaal just because I feel like I burned so many calories.
Should have gone
Bubble Boy. I like Jarhead a lot less than I remember liking it. I think the point of it is how boring this war was for this man. But I think there's a way to maybe cinematically make it a little bit more interesting than the way they told it. I don't know if it's just too long at 2 hours and might have made a better like hour and a half movie. But performances are good, but I just think the damn thing drags.
Sam Mendes is a frustrating director. I feel like he was very early because of American Beauty propped up as like he's a great filmmaker and everything he makes is great and important. Mm-hmm. And so everything I had seen post American Beauty up through like Skyfall had things to really like in it, but I don't think he had ever made like an actually great movie. Except for what, Revolutionary Road? That didn't have anything to like in it either. It's not great, and also it's miserable.
I've got a funny story about Revolutionary
Road. There are no funny stories related to Revolutionary Road.
No, this one you might like.
It's the biggest downer 2 hours of my life.
This one you might like. So I've passed out during movies twice in my life. Once was during Three Extremes. Have you ever seen Three Extremes?
I still have not.
Okay.
I almost checked it out from my library the other day. I thought it was weird that my library had it, and I almost wanted to rent it just to see what would happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's a strange movie, but there's like a section called Dumplings, and it's really gross. And
which is also a feature, right?
Yeah, I don't know how anybody could watch that as a full feature.
Okay.
But the other one was Revolutionary Road. I passed out during Revolutionary Road. Spoilers for Revolutionary Road. There is a scene with massive vagina bleeding.
Yes.
And apparently, my kryptonite is vagina bleeding in movies.
Hey, have you seen movie 43?
Yeah.
There's this. I'm going to check out Three Extremes and not rewatch Jarhead. I've learned nothing from this conversation.
Boom.
I'll talk about a few movies quickly. I saw, I don't know how to say the title, Automata? the Antonio Banderas sci-fi movie from like late last year.
Okay.
Super cheap. He's really the only, Dylan McDermott shows up for a little bit too, but Antonio Banderas is like, he's got his head shaved. He plays an insurance guy. Oh, Robert Forster is in it too.
Okay.
He's an insurance guy in a future where people rely on robots. Something has gone wrong with it's iRobot. Basically, it's like an indie iRobot, and it's got a great first 30 to 45 minutes. And I was super on board. And then I got less and less interested as the movie went on. Still impressive, I think, in terms of special effects and what they achieve on a budget. Cause I don't think it was a very expensive movie, but you would never know. I mean, it's amazing how far digital effects have come where pretty cheap houses can make really great, effects.
Yep.
If you're a science fiction fan, I absolutely think it's worth a look cause it does talk about some things, but it was not as good as I had hoped it would be given how strongly it started.
Is it a Netflix streaming?
It is on Netflix now. Yep. Yeah. It just showed up maybe last week.
Okay.
I rewatched The Class of Nukem High, and I know you're not a Troma fan.
I haven't given them too many opportunities. I've seen Poultrygeist, I've seen The Toxic Avenger. That's it.
I mean, those are two of the better ones. So yeah, honestly, if you didn't love
those.
That,
yeah, I just don't think it's for me.
And I couldn't tell you why it is for me. Yeah. I know some of it has to do with just growing up watching it. I liked the movie way more than I used to, because I used to be one of those trauma movies that actually I wasn't a huge fan of. But I liked it way more watching it this time. And part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that it's maybe a little bit less self-aware. Because I rewatched the first half of The Toxic Avenger last night, too. And it's like, they know what they're doing, and they know the kind of movie that they're making. And it's all made with a sense of humor. But they're still kind of trying to make a movie that was going to sort of appeal to everyone in theory.
Okay.
And some of their more recent stuff is like, it's so self-aware that it can only appeal to trauma fans. You know what I mean? Like all the extras are trauma fans instead of just like weird actors that they found. And, some of that early 80s stuff, it feels more like an actual movie and there's a charm to that. So I liked it way more than I used to.
That's good.
Yeah. Right. I saw Cube for the first time. Did you ever see Cube?
I saw it once in college, like 15 years ago. I thought it was really good at the time.
It's interesting. Yeah. I know Melissa wrote something about it last October when she did a whole thing on like Canadian horror films. And I keep thinking I'm a fan of Vincenzo Natali, but I think I might just be a fan of Splice.
Yeah.
Which I really like.
Splice is great.
Yeah. It's really cool. And it's not the Cube is bad. It's just, I saw Haunter. I didn't really like it. I saw that other movie he made with Jeremy Northam and Lucy Liu, and I can't think of the name of it right now. But
Ballistic X Verse 7.
I wasn't crazy
by Chaos
about that. Who do you like better, Chaos?
Yeah,
Pitoff or Tarsem?
Pitoff. Who's Pitoff?
Catwoman. He made Catwoman,
and he's in The Hunger Games. I do you think Katniss Pitoffs? Anyways, I am.
It's a one-name director battle royale right now.
I'll go... Oh, God. Just Tarsem? I'll go with Tarsem.
I think I will, too.
Yeah.
I didn't hate The Cell.
There's The Cell and then The Fall.
Yeah.
And then what else has he made?
That might be it.
Okay.
But I'll take it.
Yeah.
Cube. So, interesting idea. Like, again, done on kind of a budget. David Hewlett, obviously, is in it and is on Stargate Atlantis, so I'll always give it a pass. Had I... seen it in the late 90s when it was made or came out, I think it would have really blown me away.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem now is, I don't know, if I was Vincenzo Natali and I saw like the Saw movies, particularly Saw 2, I might have been irate because wow, does that movie owe a lot to Cube.
Right.
A real lot. Interesting ideas. I thought the acting was so uneven, particularly from the character who kind of eventually loses it.
Okay.
Do you remember kind of?
No, okay. I don't. I remember hardly anything about it except that it was very impressively shot.
Yeah. I mean, creative.
Yeah.
The acting is rough in spots. I mean, the whole movie is kind of rough, and that's part of its charm too. You know, I like sometimes when you can see a first time filmmaker really kind of pushing what he's able to do. So,
using fake babies
and using the fakest babies you've ever seen.
I couldn't tell because when I read your review before seeing that movie, and I couldn't tell every baby scene I was watching to see.
But then when the one came on,
I thought that the first one was the fake baby, and then when I saw the second one, I'm just like, oh, that's
there
the
it
fake
is.
Baby.
There it is.
Where he's like moving its hand.
Yeah, right,
stuff.
To make it seem alive. If American Sniper does win any Oscars, do you think fake baby will accept the award?
I hope
on Clint Eastwood's behalf.
I hope it pisses all over Jason Hall when he wins best. When he wins best screenplay.
Holy shit! Best screenplay. Anyway, holy shit.
Adapted from Lies.
And the last movie that I'll talk about, we kind of talked about a little bit yesterday, but it hasn't really been talked about on the podcast. Yeah. Heath wrote a column about it, so I won't say much about it. But I finally got around to seeing The Hobbit: The Battle of the Five Armies.
Boom!
I can only name four of the armies. Who is the fifth army?
The bats?
There's bats?
Wasn't there bats?
There were eagles.
I thought there were
bats
too.
That showed up when it was convenient.
Yeah. That's been a problem even with the Lord of the Rings movies, because why can't the eagles just lift up Frodo and Sam and like hover them over Mount Doom? I don't know.
Much shorter.
The eagles always remind me of like when you're playing a video game and you die, and then the eagles like pick you up and start you off where you were.
Does that happen in video games? Yeah, I don't.
I think it happens.
I haven't played that many video games.
Quite a few.
Really?
Yeah. But yeah, that movie
doesn't happen in Rampage, so I don't know about it. I don't know what
Rampage
to say about
is the bomb.
I don't know what to say. I won Rampage one time. And
get the fudge out of here.
My friend
really?
And I played it for like an entire night, and we got to the end, and it was like, congratulations. And that was it. It was, holy shit, that was a letdown.
All right, if they make Rampage into a movie, who would you want to direct it?
Oh, gosh, Gareth,
Gareth Evans.
Edwards.
Isn't Edwards? Edwards is the Godzilla guy. I always screw them up. You would want him?
Not really, but it's a giant
monster. I was going to say, it would be like somebody driving a car and you'd see it through the window.
Exactly.
That's what you want.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
He would just shoot somebody playing the video game, but he would shoot it from the back so you couldn't even see the screen.
I want chaos.
I don't. Not a bad choice.
And I want Jason Hall to write it.
I don't know what to say about Hobbit Battle of the Five Armies, except that I'm relieved that the series is over.
Yes.
I will not be returning to these movies, I don't think. I like the Lord of the Rings movies. I'm a big fan of those. I will continue to watch those for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I cannot see myself ever going back to these Hobbit movies.
I thought this was the best of the three, but I don't like any of them.
I can't even come down on that, because while it had the most action, I don't even want to spoil, like when the second one ended, I thought I had a clear idea of where the third one was going.
Yeah.
And yet that's resolved in the first 10 minutes of this movie.
Yes.
And so it made me immediately question why I sat through 3 hours of The Desolation of Smaug only to have something resolved in the first 10 minutes. And then I didn't know the rest of the movie is literally a 2.5 hour standoff in front of a mountain.
Yeah.
That's the movie.
Where's my fucking Aragorn sequel?
I don't know. All the love triangle stuff can't point to anything as saying, well, this part worked. Well, this part was good. It's not even that it's not the worst movie I've ever seen. It's not even the worst movie I saw this year. But there was not one thing I could point to and say, well, that I liked, that held my attention, that worked for me.
Yeah.
I was just bored and disappointed.
It reminds me of like if you go to a restaurant that you like and there's one dish that you really enjoyed in the past and you order it, and for some reason, like there's a different cook that night or something.
Yes.
And you're like, it's really bland tonight.
Yes, he's boiled out all the flavor.
Yeah. That's kind of how I feel about those movies. I was off board of them from the scene where the dwarves invade Bilbo's house.
Which is pretty early on in the first one.
And start eating all of his food, because that bothered me from a fundamental level. I think that's one of the worst things. I think it's such a rape of privacy. It's just terrible that I was not on board with any of their struggles for the rest of the series.
And these new movies make such a case for practical effects over digital effects. Because
they sure do,
I think this movie looks way more dated already. I don't think the effects work particularly. I mean, some of them do. The Smaug effect is very good.
But like the Billy Connolly on a pig with the massive armies and stuff, it looks terrible.
Yes. Yes. And all of the orcs or whatever. And I know some pictures leaked back when I think the first Hobbit movie came out that they had originally shot that Azog the Defiler, like the main bad orc.
Yeah.
They shot a guy in makeup and it looked awesome. And then they went back and changed it with a CGI character that does not work at all.
That's a bummer.
So good job, everyone. Yay, movies. Let's talk about Natural Born Killers. We owe it to Brian Kidd.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. I think this will engender a good discussion.
All right, so here goes. Spoilers for Natural Born Killers. I keep wanting to call it National Born Killers. Natural Born Killers are forthcoming. So in 1994, when Natural Born Killers comes out, I had seen Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
And I was very much all about Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. This is not me patting my own back. I was just a very early adopter of Quentin Tarantino. There was no internet, so I just would have to like buy issues of Premiere and Movie Line and other movie magazines and read articles. And so I knew that he had A True Romance had come out already, because that was 93, and that movie changed my life. So this was the next fix that I would be able to get prior to Pulp Fiction.
Yep.
So I saw Natural Born Killers the day it came out. I think I saw it another two times in the theater. It was the first Laserdisc I purchased in the fall of 1994. I finally saved up enough money for a Laserdisc player and bought it and Natural Born Killers on Laserdisc. So I spun it a whole bunch of times. You had made this comment yesterday. I don't think I realized how well I knew this movie. I rewatched it today.
Yeah.
And I almost knew it by heart. I mean, I really must have watched it a lot on Laserdisc because it was the only Laserdisc I had and it looked so good. And it was like, this is so neat. I have to flip the disc right after that scene at the drugstore.
That's a good place to flip it.
There's like a fucking fade out.
Yeah, it's the end of part one.
It really is. Yeah. So that worked out. And other Laserdiscs, not so fortunate.
Yeah, I remember seeing E.T. on Laserdisc at my uncle's. And I'm probably remembering this wrong, but I remember it being like on more than one disc. And you had to flip it like four times altogether.
It might have been a CAV disc as opposed to CLV.
It was crazy.
Let's talk Laserdiscs, everyone. I bought the director's cut on VHS when it came out because you could get it on a widescreen VHS.
Mm-hmm. You don't want widescreen. You want full screen.
That's right.
You're losing part of the screen.
And then at least 15 years have gone by since the last time I saw Natural Born Killers.
Okay.
And I returned to it a slightly different person.
Interesting.
I think there was a time in my youth, and I was still in high school when it came out, where I might have made the case that it was like one of the best movies of the 90s.
Okay.
I think I was taken in by the technique, which remains impressive if overly masturbatory. So I think I was like way on board. And I feel like in many, many ways, I have outgrown Natural Born Killers.
Okay.
You go ahead.
A lot of stuff that I want to comment on there. The first thing is the very last thing that you brought up, where you feel like you've outgrown the movie. And I feel like in many ways, your reaction is maybe my reaction to something like A Clockwork Orange or Fight Club. I feel like these are young man's angst movies. Yes. Like
Fight Club for sure. Clockwork Orange I've actually never really liked.
Okay.
I think I definitely feel that way about Fight Club.
Yeah, it's something where you are really worked up about it in your early 20s, where you first get that taste of like disillusionment that like you're not going to have a gravy train with biscuit wheels for the rest of your life. But and that it's going to be a struggle and you're going to have to work for things. But I never had that with Natural Born Killers per se, but I can completely understand why you would feel that way. I think that, unlike you, I didn't see it in the theaters. I was 12 when it came out. My parents were not that bad of a parents to let me see in the theaters. They were bad enough of parents to let me watch it on video.
All right.
And I was unaware of the Tarantino thing when I saw it because I didn't catch up with Pulp Fiction until like mid 95, and it just wasn't on my wavelength at the time. And when I got to Natural Born Killers, kind of the Tarantino thing aside, I was really taken in by, like you said, the technique of the movie. It was unlike anything you've ever seen before.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, like even at the time, it was maybe the first time that I can recall really kind of recognizing the work of like a cinematographer and how they can affect the language of a movie. and just kind of like the theme and the mood, especially of the movie. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've been a huge fan of Robert Richardson, and I think that his cinematography in the Oliver Stone movies and now in the Tarantino movies is beautiful. And he's just, he's like my Roger Deakins for most people. I just think that he's bar none the best cinematographer that you could get.
Yeah.
I was like you, I was very familiar with the movie when I sat down to rewatch it this week. I watched it twice. I watched the theatrical cut and then I watched the director's cut. I think I just subliminally, without even like thinking about it, I've seen it so many times on like HBO or things. It's just pops up every couple of years. You know, they'll have a run of it on TV for a month, and then I can almost always put it on and watch it for about 20, 30 minutes, as long as it's not the Native American sequences, which I really think drag and I could do without, and kind of pinpoints the more problematic aspects of the movie to me. What I get out of it now is I think it's very entertaining.
Sure.
I think that it's succeeds on its intentions really well in the fact that it's basically making you feel bad forever reveling in the hard copy, A Current Affair, Inside Edition culture of embracing crime or criminals as celebrity.
Okay.
But my problem with it is now, and I still overall like the movie. I still overall am on board with the movie.
Okay.
My big problem with it now is I think it's much more hypocritical than I ever thought that it was before. And a lot of its critics will say that it celebrates what it's meant to criticize. And if I just watched the movie on its own, I would have an argument against that. If I did what I did this week, which is watch the movie and then listen to commentaries with Oliver Stone or watch interviews with Oliver Stone, I think he's entirely hypocritical in some of the things that he's positing in this movie.
Okay.
Especially his reactions to, or his reaction and attitude towards the Mickey and Mallory characters. I think that he likes them. Mm-hmm. I think that he sees them as anti-heroes.
Absolutely. He calls them
as
much when he talks about why he changed the ending.
Yeah. And this is one of those cases where, you know, kind of going back to the Spike Lee thing where you ask him, what's your movie about? You don't want to know the answer from the filmmaker.
Specifically
Oliver Stone. And Oliver Stone was actually...
and apparently Spike Lee.
Oliver Stone was actually at that same Ebert Fest.
Oh, that's
and
right.
He was there with Born on the 4th of July. And I walked out of his Q&A. And I was the only person who walked out of it. But I just couldn't take any more listening to his just nonsensical rambling.
Yeah.
I think that his films are often brilliant. I think I'm a huge fan of Platoon. I think JFK is audacious and really, really strong. I like Heaven Nixon a lot.
Oh,
I haven't seen Heaven and Earth. I like Nixon a lot.
World Trade Center.
I'll get to that later. Because I think that he's gone soft in his old age.
He has. I would much rather see crazy early to mid 90s Oliver Stone.
I think from 86, like with Platoon through Nixon, he was one of the most ballsy filmmakers that was out there.
I think one of his movies is always worth seeing, even if I don't. It's like Spike Lee. It's like, I'm not always going to like it, but I think it's always worth seeing.
Yeah.
You know? I like Any Given Sunday.
I think it's super entertaining.
Yeah.
I actually like it better than the NFL. I would rather
I probably do too.
I could probably watch Any Given Sunday more than I could watch the NFC Championship.
But part of the problem, I think, with Oliver Stone, and maybe this will bring it back to now. I don't mean to interrupt, but
no,
when I got to Any Given Sunday, I kind of put my finger on it because there's those scenes where Al Pacino is talking about the importance of football and he's intercutting it with footage of the Roman gladiators.
Yep.
And you get, oh, Oliver Stone, this is his big thesis on why we're all into football. Like, a movie can't just be a movie. Mm-hmm. It has to be Oliver Stone's worldview. And it's like every every movie that he would approach, it was like, he can't just make the movie. He's got to give it the Oliver Stone treatment. So this is the Oliver Stone treatment on football, and Natural Born Killers is the Oliver Stone treatment on, I guess, the media. And while the media plays a huge role in Natural Born Killers, I think both the people that talked about the movie at the time and Oliver Stone himself oversell how much of Natural Born Killers is actually a critique of the media.
Yeah, in these interviews,
that's not entirely what that movie is about at all.
No,
it's one of the things.
Yeah, he talks about how it's a critique of the media. It's a critique of the prison systems and about all violence in general and all this stuff. But the thing that drives me crazy about it now is he almost absolves the Mickey and Mallory characters of any of their behavior whatsoever, because he sees them as the ones who have become, through the process of dealing with, you know, the Robert Downey Jr. character, Wayne Gale, who's like the tabloid sleazeball who interviews them in jail. He sees them as the ones who have been enlightened and have grown. Right. And
it's through their experience with the shaman. I mean, that's specifically the point at which they are supposed to transform.
And I never picked that up before this viewing, which I wouldn't have if I didn't listen to the commentary. Like, when they show the shaman and he's kind of like over the fire and doing the ritual and stuff like that, he's raising the demon out of Woody Harrelson. Right. That's what that's meant to be. And then they got this whole crap about like love beating the demon and all this stuff. But if you watch Natural Born Killers all the way through to the end,
they're monsters all the way through.
They're monsters all the way through. There's no reason to believe that they're not going to kill more people.
Right.
The fact that
the song that plays over the end credits, which is a great kind of black comedy beat.
Yeah.
I love all the Leonard Cohen music. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the lyric of the song is literally, I've seen the future, it's murder. And we see them driving off in their RV with their kids, who we just sort of predict are going to be monsters as well. So
The movie says the theory that like this is passed down, like generational violence,
which is again why it can't just be a critique of the media, because the media isn't what makes them into monsters. We're told that both of them were made into monsters by their upbringings.
Yeah, and also like the whole sequence with I Love Mallory,
yes,
which is a satire of sitcoms, and specifically, it feels like Married with Children, at least from like the dingy
because it's so ugly,
it's just how gross it is. They're basically saying that, you know, like Mallory and Mickey are kind of devoid of their humanity, in part not just because of the abuse, but because of their TV culture and because of their consumption of media and everything like that. But then when Oliver Stone is accused of his movie causing copycat crimes, he says, oh, no, it's all the individual. It's not because of what they watch or what
movies
they consume, but your movie is saying differently.
Right.
So I think that he's doesn't have a clear understanding sometimes of his material, or he's got more, he's throwing things out without thinking it through all the way.
Absolutely. Which, I mean, is part of what I like about Oliver Stone. I agree that it makes him sort of an irresponsible filmmaker, and it makes his films almost irredeemably messy at times.
Yeah.
Especially with a movie like this that I want to like and defend, and yet the quote-unquote satire is so heavy-handed and so on the nose. I mean, there's nothing remotely subtle about this movie. But I also would argue that Oliver Stone isn't interested in making subtle movies.
No.
You know, I mean, you don't construct Natural Born Killers the way he does if you're interested in a subtle commentary on media. I mean, my problem with that whole notion is, and I want to come back to I Love Mallory, with the exception of that scene in the hotel room where we see Woody Harrelson watching Scarface, and there's a few times where we see shots of movies or TV shows kind of rear projected in the background.
Yep.
We are never really shown them consuming media at all. So this idea that somehow that's the way that the world is reflected back to them doesn't work for me. And I want to talk about I Love Mallory, and then I want to talk about the technique used in the movie, because I can't say as I totally understand it. It makes the movie unique. So I Love Mallory is really, I think, the movie's standout sequence.
Mm-hmm.
I think even people who don't like the movie, and there are a lot of them, point to that and say, oh yeah, but that scene is great. And there's a reason for that, I think. And that's maybe just because I feel like that was the first time we really saw that done, where something that just unremittingly dark. It is so fucking dark what goes on in that scene. Contrasted with the laugh track, contrasted with the form of it all. I love when Woody Harrelson first enters and he looks over to where the audience would be and he kind of smiles, because you realize just like, oh, right, he's done. This was Cheers. I mean, this was, we got to talk about him in a second.
Yeah, I want to talk about that for sure.
So I think that works, and that is really the only scene, except for some of the Wayne Gale stuff at the end, that sort of comments on this idea of seeing your life as a movie, seeing yourself reflected, like you're playing a character in something that you've watched, you know, like that you, that you observe the world through the lens of media. To me, True Romance does it way better. That True Romance is all about Clarence being the character in his own movie. And it's never on the nose about it. It never says this is what we're doing, but to me that really works. And in Natural Born Killers, when it's trying to say like, well, the media shapes who these people are and how they act, I don't see that at all.
No, I would agree with that. And I think talking about True Romance, I mean, Tarantino has said as much, where he was happy that Tony Scott directed it at his point, at Tarantino's point in his career, that he wrote True Romance, because Christian Slater's character would have seen his life as a Tony Scott movie.
Yes.
And so it completely makes sense.
Yes.
I don't think that Mickey and Mallory see themselves as being the heroes of an Oliver Stone movie.
Right.
And also, one thing that bothers me about their characters is, I feel like just in the process of them going to jail, all of a sudden, their IQs seem to have gone up by like 100 points each. Because in the first part of the movie, I think it's more representative, and I don't know, I mean, I'm not a criminal psychologist or anything like that, but from watching like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, or like reading stuff about crime and things like that, just, or consumption of media or whatever, or news, most killers are dull. They're just like weird, sociopathic, antisocial. They're not charismatic, like people. And I feel like in the first half of the movie, the Mickey and Mallory characters are portrayed as more of hayseeds, kind of. They're you know, just trash. And in the second half of the movie, we're supposed to think that they're, like, they got their doctorates or something in prison, and they're just like experts on manipulation of the media and all this stuff, where I don't feel like that's who they are in the first half of the movie.
Well, right, again, because I feel like Oliver Stone is trying to force a lot of that. The media stuff is really in the second half, and so he's decided, like, well, this is going to be my big critique of the media. And so, to the point where, I mean, the movie ends with those shots of Tanya Harding and O.J. Simpson and
Rodney King.
Yeah. It was interesting. I like that he does cut away before Get Along, though. It was interesting watching that, because I thought, okay, in 10 years, or even now, if you showed this to somebody now, with the exception of O.J. Simpson, none of that has any context. Does it need to?
I don't think so.
You know what I mean?
I think that this movie, in the terms of like trashy tabloid TV, I think that it's a good time capsule of like what it was like to view that part of the pop culture.
Okay.
In 1994, one thing that I did like that Oliver Stone said in a comment, I think it was a commentary, he says that the reason why Mickey and Mallory, in the cut that got released, in the director's cut and the theatrical cut, the reason why they get away at the end is because in the 90s, that's what would happen.
Sure.
And I think that's spot on.
Yes.
I think that's really just wise, because the deleted scene, alternate ending, which isn't in either of the cuts, but it's available like as a deleted scene, is that this avenging angel played by Arliss Howard, who's the baddest of the bad. He's like the devil or something like that. He's the only badass more badass enough than Jack Scagnetti, who can take out Mickey and Mallory, kills Mickey and Mallory, and then cut to black. That's the end of the movie.
Right.
And then it goes to the end credits. And I don't think that, I mean, it's, I don't know, maybe more realistic of maybe what would happen in real life, that they would meet a violent end as opposed to a happily ever after end. But
yes, in terms of yes, but it ruins sort of the yeah. the satire of it, if you're going to call this movie a satire, that yeah. yeah, they would get away with it. I mean, part of it too, I think, is, you know, he wants them to get away because he likes them.
Yeah.
And
it's really troubling.
It is. And yet I think some of that has to do with their performances, because I would argue that they're both very charismatic in this movie.
Yeah, let's
talk the Arliss about Howard stuff. We'll come right back to the performances. Yeah. The Arliss Howard stuff is interesting because he's actually placed a bunch of times throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And so to take out the scene where he ends up murdering them, mm-hmm. now it almost doesn't make sense why he's placed throughout the movie, except that he randomly shows up to help them get out of jail.
Yeah.
But that does not excuse placing him in that diner at the beginning. I mean, he kind of shows out like this ghostly figure, shows up as this like ghostly figure throughout the movie, which, if he's ultimately a sign of their doom, that kind of makes sense, right? But mm-hmm. to take that out, now he just shows up in the diner like, what the fuck is this?
It's like, oh, he's the guy who's gonna help us escape right? from jail.
Oh,
later.
There, yeah.
Isn't it cool we had this premonition about him?
I thought it was very interesting though, and I rewatched that deleted scene, and I remember thinking this when I first saw it, like in the 90s or whenever I saw that scene for the first time, that when the time comes, he goes to kill Woody Harrelson, and Woody Harrelson just smiles. Mm-hmm. Woody Harrelson seems to sort of be at peace with the whole thing.
Yeah.
But Juliette Lewis
Kind of cowers. Yeah.
And like is kind of called on all of her bullshit. It almost reframes her entire character, I think.
Yeah.
Not in necessarily a way that makes the movie better. I just thought that was an interesting choice, that when that moment comes, they approach it very, very differently. And how does that make us rethink everything that we've seen before?
Yeah. And I think that, yeah, it is kind of interesting, because like as the movie goes along, you know, Mickey and Mallory are kind of equals, and then that action at the end sort of makes it where she's maybe more of Mickey's pushover.
Right.
Which is interesting, but I feel like with the volume of murders that they're said to be credited for, you have to have like a clear line of sight to, you can't like be 1 foot
right
dipping your toe in the water to kill 52 people.
And she's also shown committing murders on her own when he's not around.
Right.
So it's not like a situation where she's just going along with it, or, you
know. It's not like Bonnie and Clyde.
Or Badlands or whatever. Yeah. Okay. So should we talk about performances?
I would love to.
Okay.
So you had mentioned Woody Harrelson before.
Yes.
How interesting is it that this is the first time that they really kind of tapped into his darker side?
Yes.
And the thing that really I find so fantastic about it, about his performance in this movie, is he doesn't change his personality all that much. It's not all that different from you know, he's smarter than Woody. He's more savvy.
Right.
Or not Woody. What was his name on
Woody?
Was it Woody? Yeah, Woody was on Cheers. Yeah. And then, but he did, you know, White Men Can't Jump. He was in like Wildcats. He was in, Doc Hollywood. It was all like lighter comedic stuff. And if you look at him from those movies and this movie, it's still him kind of doing the Woody Harrelson persona, but it's just to such darker effect. And that just sort of shows off his range, where he doesn't have to overplay something to come off as creepy or to come off as more sincere. And I just think that he's such an underrated actor.
Yeah.
I think he's really good. He's almost always turns in a really good performance, but this is the one that kind of really was interesting, because they took him kind of down a path that he's never been before.
Yeah.
And I think has opened up a whole other range of roles for him later in his career because of his work in this one.
Yeah. I would argue this is kind of the one that made him a movie star.
Yeah.
I mean, White Man Can't Jump did well, but it was always, he was the TV guy who's now, you know, doing movies. But this one showed that he could carry a movie in a really interesting way, and credit to whoever had the idea to cast him. Not only because it does play against our expectations, but because, like you said, he's not doing that much that's different. It's just tweaked a little bit, but it's really, really dark. And whoever saw that darkness in him, credit to them. And Juliette Lewis, you know, I think ends up being written off sometimes as an actress because she tends to do the same kind of thing over and over again.
Yeah, I had a joke about Juliette Lewis I was maybe going to use earlier in the show, but it was basically, she's being herself in this movie, and the performance is her in her real life.
I was going to make that joke when Tom Sizemore strangled the prostitute, that this was just
Pinky's adorable
home video.
I want to see a spinoff movie with Pinky the prostitute.
Yeah.
Because she's just adorable.
She did not deserve what happened.
No, she didn't.
And by that, I mean seeing Tom Sizemore in bikini underwear.
No, but this is the movie that if you think of Juliette Lewis, like what's her career defining performance, it's this.
Yes. And some of that is because it's so much like the character that she played in California, mm-hmm. that was kind of a version of the character she had done in Cape Fear. Again, I think people think that she is this character so much that they think, well, she's not acting. She's just this crazy animal, who plays, you know, kind of like white trash very, very well. Mm-hmm. And I think people said that when Cape Fear came out. Well, how hard is it for her to play a 16-year-old girl? She's basically a 19-year-old girl or whatever. And that's fine. But I would encourage you to rewatch Natural Born Killers because, yes, a lot of times it's big and crazy and she's jumping around and singing and making faces and going, there's no escaping here.
You stupid bitch.
You stupid. There are so many things I still quote from this movie. I really must have seen it a lot of times.
When I see this movie, I can't get the soundtrack out of my head for a week.
Yeah. But there are moments where she does really good, really interesting, almost subtle things. So I would encourage you to watch it again and just pay really close attention to her performance. Because I actually think it's really, really good.
Yeah.
And the two of them, I think, are actually very believable as people who really think the world revolves around one another.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to sell because we have to kind of buy into their crazy love story to go on this, whether we're seeing them as the heroes or the anti-heroes, or just if we want to accept this premise of these crazy people who build a world around themselves, you know, at which they are the center. We have to buy that relationship, and we totally do.
Yeah, I think that if either of them were the subject of this movie on their own, the audience would hate them even more. But the fact that they're together and that they love each other so much,
right?
It almost softens it a little bit, allowing for the later kind of satire to go down easier. Because one thing that I find really interesting about this movie is, for as ugly as it is, and for as kind of headache-inducing it can be at times with the technique, it's not a movie where I feel... I don't even know how to put it. Not scared of it, but there's certain movies that you just kind of feel icky watching.
Okay.
And this is one where, despite the subject matter, I don't feel the same way I do as if I watch Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Absolutely not.
It's something that feels kind of more pop, pop entertainment.
Yes. And is that Oliver Stone doing his job correctly, or is that Oliver Stone totally fucking up? Because again, if you want to talk about a movie that's a condemnation of violence, mm-hmm. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is 100% a condemnation of violence.
Yeah.
It presents it almost without feeling,
mm-hmm.
And it's horrible to watch, and it's difficult to watch, and you never want to see it again. And this movie, there's way more violence in the movie, but it's all movie violence.
Yep.
It's cut together in a very flashy way. So is that Oliver Stone failing to condemn the violence, or is that Oliver Stone packaging it in such a way so as to tie into his critique of media representations of these kinds of characters?
Maybe it's both.
Okay.
Yeah. I would agree with both of those points.
Yeah,
for sure.
I don't know. Should we talk about the style real quick, or do you want to finish out? Should we talk about RDJ and TLJ?
I do want to talk about them.
Okay.
I've gone on record many times as not being a fan of Robert Downey Jr.
Yes.
I love him in this movie.
This is so weird. I loved him in 1994. Watching him today, I loved him less.
Okay.
And maybe that's because I think I saw the shtick a little bit more.
Okay.
And again, this came from a period where he wasn't getting hired that much.
No.
He was a liability on sets, and yet I would go see him and stuff, and he was always just fucking killing it.
Yep.
I like the ridiculous Australian accent. I think he does some things that are really, really great. I think when he begs not to be killed, I think that works. And then he decides to be killed because he's on camera. It's like, all right, we get your point. Mm-hmm. I loved him a little bit less.
Yeah, I think that at this point in his career, I like his performance, and especially kind of his, I don't know, I try not to let, it's sometimes impossible to separate an off-screen persona and like performances. Just look at Mel Gibson, for example.
Right.
With Robert Downey Jr., I just, especially lately, have gotten just like a smug superiority thing.
Sure, sure.
And that really bothers me more than most things with performers. I just can't handle smugness. So when he plays Tony Stark and he's a hero and everybody loves him, I feel like I'm the only one who's seeing something that no one else is seeing. Whereas when I feel like a character like his character as Wayne Gale in Natural Born Killers is supposed to be a scumbag, and I feel like, I'm not saying he's Robert Downey Jr. is a scumbag, but that's how I feel about him. I feel like he's a scumbag. I can much more enjoy his performance because I feel like people in film fandom aren't treating him like a hero.
Okay.
So it's complicated, but it's like, it's really weird. I don't know. I feel like he's an asshole and I don't want people to like him.
Okay. I mean, he very much is enjoying his performance in this movie.
Yeah.
And really embraces all of the characters' dickishness, you know, like he's a terrible, terrible person. And Robert Downey Jr. is not shy away from that. Doesn't try to make him
more sympathetic.
Yeah. Right. And so he's definitely very entertaining when he comes on screen, and I certainly like his phony indignation when he's interviewing Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, I was in Grenada when the shit went down.
Right. I mean, it's very funny how worked up he gets again, and he's playing Geraldo Rivera and all these people of the time. Sizemore works because he's Sizemore, and it's like he's playing himself.
Yeah. Which is scary, very, very frightening, but he's super effective in this movie.
Yeah. And Tommy Lee Jones is, but again, the movie lets Mickey and Mallory off the hook a little bit by presenting characters who are arguably more monstrous than they are, but functioning within regular society. It was something that I kind of talked about with Nightcrawler, that when Rene Russo and Lou Bloom go out, they're kind of the same, only she fakes it better. Mm-hmm. So Scagnetti fakes it better. Wayne Gale fakes it better. But they're all as big of, if not worse, monsters than Mickey and Mallory because they fake it, whereas this movie would argue, it seems, Mickey and Mallory are more pure, that they're willing to be themselves.
Yeah, they're honest in their conviction.
Right, that they're not faking it.
Yeah, and that somehow excuses them.
So they get to murder everyone. And,
yeah, it's bizarre. And then Tommy Lee Jones, I feel like he must have had
a few extra days, a good time working on Heaven and Earth.
I feel like Tommy Lee Jones walked from the set of Natural Born Killers, applied his makeup while he was on foot, and walked straight into Batman Forever, and then walked back and forth.
I have a hard time with
change his performance.
I have a hard time with over the top Tommy Lee Jones. I don't think he does big well.
I think he's very funny in this movie in what the fuck is this actor doing type of way.
Yeah.
But, it's funny to me to see him so humorless in like an interview.
Yes.
And then watch him do something like this.
Right.
So I find it really interesting.
Right.
And I enjoy his performance from that standpoint, but yeah, even for a satire, I mean, this is crazy over the top.
And at that point in the movie, the movie can support it at that point.
Yes.
I think if he had come along in the very first scene, I think it would have been too much. But by the time we get to the prison, things are so crazy and out of control. And we've been through 18 different film stocks and animations. And like, we're just ready for whatever this movie is going to throw at us.
Yep.
So it gives us something bigger than anything we've seen yet. And that is Tommy Lee Jones' performance in this movie.
Yeah. One thing I also want to give the movie credit for is in the prison sequence, I can't remember too many movies that have sustained that level of craziness and mayhem for that long. And it's super effective. It feels like just you watching it on your television, it feels dangerous. It feels scary. I'm convinced 9 or 10 people really died like during the making of this movie. There's no fucking way that nobody died, that like nobody didn't die during the making of this movie.
Yeah.
It's like the Raid 2 of like Oliver Stone movies.
I'm so distracted when that one cameraman though says like he's got the backpack with the beta cam, because I want him to say like Marvin Nash. So
I never put that together.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. My it's God. The exact, and it's the same like the way he kind of pleads. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's Marvin Nash.
Speaking of Tarantino tip for a second, did you know that he told, I guess Tim Roth and Steve Buscemi were up for parts in this movie?
Okay,
and he told them he would never work with them again if they did Natural Born Killers.
Really?
Yeah,
interesting.
Tarantino is interesting with this movie because he goes back and forth between, you know, it's not my movie anymore. It's Oliver's thing. And like, I fucking hate that movie. And like, I can't make it past the I Love Mallory sequence, which he says is like terrible.
Really? Interesting.
He's got weird taste. Like, but he I does think have that I haven't read the Tarantino script for.
Nor have I. It was much more straightforward, I think.
For Natural Born Killers. Yeah. Well, they said that it would focus more on Wayne Gale and his crew than it did on Mickey and Mallory. And I think it would be fascinating to see his material get filmed, but I don't know. I mean, like, I feel at the same time that we're in a way lucky to have a movie that's this out there.
Sure, yeah. And it's not like anything else.
Yeah, it's definitely like an art movie. I don't think that it's cliche to say this, but I don't think it's the type of movie that would really be made today by a Warner Brothers.
No, we don't get a lot of big budget experimental films.
No, and I miss that, because like this was at the time like with Spike Lee and with Oliver Stone, where they were making message movies and having, you know, sizable budgets to do it with in major studios. But everything now is, you know, how much money is it going to turn around? And, you know, like even the quote unquote message movies are much more soft pedaling in their points of view. This is definitely not something where somebody's holding back.
Right. And I wonder how I would respond to this movie if I saw it today as an adult, like if it was new and I saw it as an adult, because when I saw it as a high school kid, I really responded to it because it was so kind of out there and daring and different from everything else I'd seen. But I was aware of the larger critical community, with the exception of like Roger Ebert, mostly shitting on it and just calling it kind of trash and obnoxious and really heavy handed. And it wasn't that I couldn't understand those things, because I could see those things in the movie, but I just felt like, maybe it's more of like a young man's game. But I don't know if that's the case. I don't know. I want to go back to two things quickly, and then I want to talk about this style.
Sure.
One, the Tarantino thing is interesting. I don't think there's any of him in this movie. Like, if it never said story by Quentin Tarantino, I don't know that there's anything in this movie.
I think some of the dialogue is a little cutesy in the way that a Tarantino script can be.
Maybe. I don't hear any of him. I don't really see any of his stuff coming up a lot, except for maybe when like Juliette Lewis has her feet sticking out of the car. But I know he's generally kind of bitter about it. There's a book. Did you ever read Killer Instinct?
No.
Okay. So it's a book written by one of the producers of this film, possibly two of the producers.
Okay.
Very much worth reading out. It's just about the making of this movie, the buying of the script, and it does not have nice things to say about hardly anyone. Tarantino comes off like a monster. Oliver Stone comes off like a fucking asshole. Everybody comes off terribly, and it sounds like it was a nightmare to put together, but totally worth reading.
Yep.
So that was one. Two, and I was kind of going to save this for the end, but I'm glad that you mentioned it now. So I was going to ask earlier, like when I was talking about those shots at the end of Tonya Harding and O.J. Simpson and the Menendez brothers and John Wayne Bobbitt or whatever. That without any context, does that stuff work? And you said, well, no, it's a time capsule. And I'm always kind of bouncing back and forth. Does a movie need to work at its time, or does a movie need to be timeless?
The funny thing is, one of the questions I wrote down to ask you was, if we didn't come up with in the course of conversation, was, has this movie aged well? And I think that it has aged well. It doesn't feel irrelevant or passé. And I think that part of it has to do with the time capsule element. And then part of it is just, I think that maybe not so much like the trashy tabloid TV aspect of it exists still, but I think that there's a lot still of the self-made celebrity.
Absolutely.
Or the celebrity for the wrong reason.
Right. We're still obsessed with covering crime and violence.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I don't think that it would ever go to the extent of an interview with serial killers on national television after the Super Bowl or anything like that. But if they filmed a interview with serial killers, which they have, like with Geraldo, with Charles Manson and stuff like that. I mean, like shit like that would still get watched, like,
oh yeah,
20, 30, 40 years after the fact, and not just by people studying criminology. It would just be by somebody who's bored and wants to watch something a little lurid.
Right.
So I think that it's sad, but I think like a lot of the themes almost that Oliver Stone doesn't necessarily support real well in the context of the movie. It's like real life has made his argument for him.
Sure.
A little bit.
Sure. And I don't even have an answer to that question. Like, does a movie need to be timeless or relevant? Because I think both can be true and I think both can be effective. I was feeling like watching some of this movie, I felt like it was very much of the 90s, very much commenting on things that were happening in the 90s. Its style is sort of very much of the 90s.
The music, I think, it's very much of that alternative scene.
Right.
And,
which is okay, again, for it to be a time capsule, like you said. But then we get to the prison scene. Mm-hmm. And this is where the movie, for me, started to feel kind of timeless, or at least still holds up. Because one of the things that I always felt like the movie was about was not so much the media creating celebrities, the media, you know, making killers into rock stars or whatever. To me, it always seemed like a movie about all of these forces that are like too big to be contained. So we have Mickey and Mallory that are just too big to be contained. We have Jack Scagnetti that's just too big to be contained. We introduce Tommy Lee Jones, too big to be contained. Wayne Gale. Mm-hmm. And it's not until the prison that all of these forces are finally in the same place. And so what's going to happen? It's going to explode, right?
Yep.
And watching that prison sequence and watching I was having the exact same response you were, that like it feels scary and dangerous. It really did feel like how I feel about America right now. I feel like we are in the process of like, it's all just going to burn to the ground. You know what I mean? Like, it's a scary time that we're living in because of just a lot of things that are going on. Mm-hmm. And we have all these things that are too big to be contained and it's all just going to explode. And so watching that prison sequence, I really felt like it was the best reflection of the way I feel about sort of the tenor in the country right now. And in that way, I think the movie is kind of timeless. Because I think a lot of what it's saying, like you said, is still true. Whether it meant to say those things about... See, I don't think it was trying to say those things about 1994. But no, I think they're true in 2015.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, this is stuff that I'm usually kind of... I bite my tongue a little bit about, but I feel like since we got, you know, the platform to do it now, we might as well. No, but I mean, it's very much police brutality. It's very much, you know,
people like, are angry.
People are angry.
People are angry everywhere about everything.
Yeah, it's crazy.
People are angry about American Sniper. Like, we're pitting American Sniper against Selma.
Yes.
Two movies that have no business being pitted against one another, but we're doing it because we're angry about something else.
Yeah.
And it just is, it feels scary and it feels like this prison sequence at the end.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, that's a great point. It's something that, it's really, that's the thing that I like about Oliver Stone movies so much is that they just bulldoze you.
Right.
I mean, they're super effective from just emotional heft. Like when I watch Platoon, I mean, I'm fucking drained at the end of that
Platoon
movie.
I don't rewatch Platoon.
Okay.
It's rough.
Yeah. I've seen it maybe like three or four times, but it's like that. And like Apocalypse Now, it's like the movies where I'll watch it and then I can't talk to anybody for like 2 hours.
Right.
I just need to feel horrible for a while. And I mean, Oliver Stone's got missteps. Like The Doors, I think, is just, oh God, it's just a fucking
it's kind of a drag,
a nightmare to get through.
Yeah.
But I
mean, and yet in that way, it's sort of like,
it's effective for what it's trying to do.
It's trying to show you about an asshole who self-destructed and made everyone miserable. And it's like, well, that's what that movie fucking does.
Yeah.
And yet I think that movie tries to deify him a little bit, because that's what Oliver Stone does, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. One thing I wanted to ask you was, 1999 is often propped up as a watershed moment for movies.
Yes.
I've always felt like I've been in the minority of thinking that it's the second best year for movies of the 90s. I think 1994 is a better year for movies than the 90s, because you've got...
What do you have in 94?
Pulp Fiction.
Okay, sure.
Shawshank Redemption. Hoop Dreams.
Yeah.
Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
Speed.
Okay. These are good.
Flintstone. The Lion King, which I think is good. All right. I like The Lion King.
No, it's fine. No. It's not bad.
You got Quiz Show.
Okay.
You've got...
a lot of good stuff.
Yeah. Four Weddings and a Funeral, I think, was 94.
It was, but... Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I think that there's just tons of enduring movies that came out that year.
Sure.
And maybe it's just more, these are the movies that kind of have stuck with me than like the stuff in 99. I really respect and admire a lot of movies from 1999, but I don't go back to them as much as the movies from 94.
Okay.
But it's, it's funny because, I don't know if you feel the same way also, but all right. So 2014, we talk about it as like this fantastic year for movies.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just because it's
the year
that
Steve Carell played John DuPont in Foxcatcher, Oscar nominee Steve Carell. Continue. I'm sorry.
Oh my God. I thought we weren't giving comedians Oscar nominations for dramatic roles. Apparently the Academy just fucking hates Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
Anyways, Steve. All right. That makeup looks like you bought it at a dollar store.
I thought that narrative had already died. Like, I thought before the movie came out, it was like, this is going to be the one that gets him an Oscar nomination. And the movie came out and I was like, nobody's talking about it. Nobody's talking about him. That narrative is dead. Right. So it floored me to see that he was nominated, but who cares?
Yeah. I don't know. But I can't see recent years as classic years for movies. I can say, oh, there was a lot of good movies that came out this year or that year.
Well, I think we need distance.
Yeah, we need, I need distance from it, because I feel like there's, in 94 or 99, I'm like, there are true blood classics that came out those years.
Yeah.
Whereas, in these recent years, I have trouble saying, like, this is the best year for movies since blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah, just because of that.
But 10 or 15 years from now, we may be, saying Foxcatcher is a classic. So I do want to address the style of the movie, because I think that's the first thing everyone thinks of, and we probably should have gotten to it already. So he takes what he does in JFK and he cranks it up to 1,000.
Yes.
And yet, I ask, to what purpose? I think it makes the movie singular. I think it makes the movie interesting to watch at times. I think it makes the movie headache inducing. I remember getting a really bad headache after seeing this movie for the first time, especially in a theater. Because I don't think the movie makes the case that their lives are constructed, defined by their consumption of various media.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the style is designed as a reflection of that. So what is it there for?
I think I have an answer for it.
All right.
All right, let's look at the movie in two halves, pre-jail and post-jail.
Okay.
First half is the ADD thrill kill type of mentality.
Okay.
Where they see things as, it's like this heightened reality that they've created for themselves.
And some of that stuff works. The bullet going through the window and the opera music. I mean, some of that stuff, I would say this is how they see the world.
Yeah. They don't see it in a straightforward way.
Right.
They see it in a, what are they called? Dutch angle.
Right.
Strange, you know,
black, like, and white 16 black, millimeter way.
Sure, I guess.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like he did it in JFK because he's trying to recreate
newsreel footage,
right, or whatever. Yeah. Like, why here?
And then I think the aesthetic works in the second half of the movie, just because it part of it is just to nullify some of the violence.
Sure.
Because especially in the director's cut, I mean, there's people like guards getting thrown in washing machines and like being dragged across tables and put in ovens.
Oh, jeez.
And I mean, like, it gets fucking, like, insane. So yeah. I think part of it is just to kind of make it a little bit more palatable.
Okay.
And then part of it is Because it's chaos, it's chaotic, so like right. it should be shot that way. That's kind of how I always justified it. I think that it's like eating too much. It's like eating a diet of nothing but candy for an
right.
entire day.
Right.
You are going to get sick of, you're going to want to throw up by the end of it. And I think that what Oliver Stone is trying to do, from the technique to what it's saying, to the characters, to everything, like by the end of this movie, you are going to be wanting to be sick of this worldview so much right. that you just want to throw it up. And like, that's 1994 to him.
Right.
That's how the world looks at that time.
See, part of me is looking for that sort of thematic justification in terms of this media angle, because I think that's the thing that everybody pushes, but I don't think that holds up. I think that idea that I have about things being kind of breaking apart, systems breaking down, and like being too much to contain. I mean, that's certainly the approach that mm-hmm. this is, like, it's too much movie, you yeah. know, the frame almost can't take how much movie is going on here. So I think it works in that way. Again, I'm glad that it was shot this way because it does make the movie different. It does feel like this big, expensive studio experimental film, mm-hmm. but sometimes I think, and maybe I'm just judging it based on other things that Oliver Stone has done, that like he saw that it worked in JFK, and so he decided to do it again, because yeah. he does some of it in Nixon, and like yeah. boy, you don't need it in Nixon. He does moments of it in Any Given Sunday. It's like, that doesn't have to be your thing, Oliver mm-hmm. Stone. It has to serve the story that you're telling.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, there's a ton of black and white 16 millimeter used. I would have liked to have been on set the day they shot all of the like screaming heads, like Robert Downey Jr. as the devil.
And oh my God. That would have been like the scariest face. Day just on set ever.
Crazy subliminal shit that he sneaks in.
Yeah.
So, and I remember this from the Laserdisc. There was a chapter stop on the Laserdisc. It's the shot of them on the bridge right after they get married, where she has the red doll.
Yeah.
She drops it in. That was a chapter stop. And that was always the thing that I went to like appreciate my new Laserdisc player. I mean, where we have come to in terms of like, how good things look on home video is so much further advanced than Laserdisc. But at that time, it was like, it was so much better than VHS that's what I would watch over and over again. Because every time we get to the black and white 16 millimeter, and then they cut to a color 35 millimeter shot of Robert Richardson's photography, it is like so gorgeous. There is such beautiful photography, a lot of that stuff. And again, sometimes it feels like this is how they see the world. And then sometimes it just feels like Oliver Stone kind of having a wank. So I can't.
Yeah. And it could be both. I mean,
and I guess I struggle with that.
Yeah.
I struggle with that idea that like it's intentional and accidental. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like he kind of got drunk on filmmaking techniques during this period.
Which is like, kind of cool, right?
Yeah,
like maybe not enough filmmakers do that.
It's like a phase and
right,
everything.
Right.
There are two things that came to mind that I wanted to ask you about before we wrapped. One was late career Oliver Stone and kind of what happened to him, because it seems like there is a through line from, say, Platoon to about Any Given Sunday. Then he's off for 5 years and he makes Alexander, which is a complete disaster.
That was one of those Battle of the Five Armies experiences where, like, 10 minutes in, I knew that I really wanted it to be over.
Yeah.
And I still had 2 hours and 50 more minutes with only one Rosario Dawson scene to get me through it.
Yeah, I walked out of Alexander after 30 minutes.
And there's a longer director's cut.
I know. Yeah, it's something that announces its mediocrity immediately. And it just...
by casting Colin Farrell.
It's terrible. But like,
who is a fine actor, just miscast.
Yeah, that movie is just a complete disaster. I mean, even Roger Ebert, who is a huge fan of Oliver Stone, he said that was the worst movie of that year.
Really?
Yeah, he gave it like 2 stars, and then he went back and he's just like, no, it's the worst movie of the year.
It's bad.
World Trade Center, for that material, is very reverential, I guess.
Sure.
Compared to what you would think. You would think that he would make like a Zero Dark Thirty type of.
It seems like all the piss was gone from Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
Like all the anger, all the sort of righteous craziness is gone.
That's especially how I felt about W.
Yes.
I thought that this was, not to reveal my politics, I'm liberal, but you don't let fucking George W. Bush off the hook because he's an idiot. You fucking scorched earth this motherfucker because he is responsible for a lot of horrible things that took years and years and we're still coming out of because of his horrible policies and just indifference to. And Oliver Stone makes a like a comedy about it.
Well, it was a huge disappointment, and not because it didn't reaffirm my beliefs, but because when it was sort of trying to understand him in a real way, I thought that was interesting, even if I didn't necessarily have the patience, you know, because I wasn't a fan. And so I was just like, I don't know, but I was willing to go with it. But again, it just felt like a movie that was like, any rough edges were sanded off and you had weird performances by people doing imitations.
Like SNL and imitations, yes, yeah.
A fascinating, the idea of it sounded interesting in that sort of early 90s Oliver Stone way. Like, oh, he's going to make this biopic about a sitting president. You know, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
And then the result was just very, very
vanilla.
Limp.
Yeah. And Savages, and I'm forgetting
something. I fucking forgot Savages. That's Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
I mean, that had a little bit of like his mid 80s craziness, like his Salvador kind of days.
Yeah.
I think that movie's watchable, but a mess.
Seen it once, and then the ending soured me on the whole
experience. Can't even remember the ending. All I remember is Blake Lively saying, what is the line that is the worst line?
Wargasms.
Oh, wargasms might be the worst thing ever written.
Yeah.
The movie you are forgetting, my friend, is Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. Because talk about a missed fucking opportunity.
Yeah.
Because I saw that trailer where Gordon Gekko gets out of the car.
Isn't
he's waiting outside.
PG-13?
It might
too?
Be. I mean, I thought it had such a good trailer in terms of Gordon Gekko being a man out of time now that he's been in prison and the world has changed so much.
Yeah.
And it had such a, I really thought it had such a great first trailer. We should have known when he called it Money Never Sleeps that it was going to be a garbage movie. But talk about a subject, again, that's really do for the Oliver Stone treatment, and can he do for the current economic climate or the current Wall Street situation what he, you know, theoretically did for the Reaganomics in the 80s? And holy shit, does he not even understand the character of Gordon Gekko anymore?
No, he sure doesn't. And then his next movie is, I think he's trying to work on something about Snowden, and we'll see how that goes. I would have much rather seen the 94 Oliver Stone.
His best days are very much behind him.
Yeah.
Very much.
One funny anecdote about the Ebert Fest that he was at was, I recommend going to Ebert Fest for everybody at least once just to sit in the Q&As and just listen to some of the insane comments and questions.
Q&As make me way too uncomfortable.
They are not even Q&As in most regards. It's just people kind of getting up and confessing things.
Right.
So one guy, when he was talking to he was with Spike Lee, he said, he's like, don't you think that things have gotten a lot better? I mean, we don't have these kinds of problems anymore. And Spike Lee, that was the last question they said beforehand. They're just like, okay, is the last question. And Spike Lee's just like, I will stay another 45 minutes because that is not going to be the last fucking thing anyone says.
Holy cow.
But one thing that really...
It's about the blood.
Yeah, it's about the blood. Who's got it? Well, it's about the blood. Who's got it? Who needs it? Anyways, and then for Oliver Stone, this guy gets up. And this is when I walked out. The guy gets up and he goes, I just want to thank you for being the only one who will tell us the truth.
Oh, wow.
And I'm a pretty big Oliver Stone defender.
Right.
But, oh my God, if you can't tell from listening to this guy talk for 20 minutes that he's kind of insane, then I don't, then you are insane as well.
Right. Again, his insanity is part of his appeal.
Yes.
Because you watch something like JFK and you're not thinking, finally, only one guy will tell me the truth. You're thinking, this is what a crazy person thinks.
Right.
Whether or not it's true, I couldn't say. It doesn't matter. I like seeing what a crazy person thinks.
Yeah. I can't even fathom watching his like documentary series about the untold story of America.
Yeah.
I can't even wrap my head around that.
Mike has one of my favorite Q&A stories at the John Carpenter Q&A. So he stood up and basically said, like, hey, you used to be married to Adrienne Barbeau, right? Yeah, I was. how come you guys like couldn't make it work? Like, why did you get a divorce 30 years ago, John Carpenter?
And then he said, it's about the blood. Who's got it? And she needed it. The one thing I wanted to remember, I didn't want to forget asking you, is I didn't have the opportunity to see Natural Born Killers in theaters.
Yes.
When you did see it in theaters,
yes,
what was the overall kind of like vibe from the audience after it was over?
I honestly don't remember. I mean, I have to believe there were like walkouts, but I don't remember there being any, because I was, you know, like this 15-year-old kid, mm-hmm. just like super excited about this movie that just had story by credit by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
So I was pretty caught up in that part of it. So I do not remember what the tenor of the theater was when it ended. I remember the critical reaction being pretty negative and kind of hanging my hat on the fact that Roger Ebert really liked it.
Yeah.
But he was always a fan of movies that kind of went out there, you know, mm-hmm. and Natural Born Killers, for better or worse, certainly goes out there.
Yeah, it right? sure does. Yeah.
All right. Are we good?
It's about the money. Who's got it? And whoever sleeps.
Thank you guys very, very much for listening. Adam, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
And I should congratulate you. Last week, Heath Holland posted his 100th column. And so I posted a comment in the underneath. And I was like, oh, congratulations, Heath. Mm-hmm. Happy to have you for 100 columns. Hope to have you for 100 more. At this point, I'm pretty sure you've written well over 100 columns.
Yeah.
And so congratulations. And
thank you.
I'm very, very glad you write for us.
Yeah, I'm happy to write for you and the F This Movie community. I love all you guys. I think it's the most level-headed and just diplomatic.
Just wait. Till they tear into us on this Natural Born Killers thing.
You know what? If they do, then
just wait till they come after us on our thoughts on The Wedding Ringer.
I actually kind of,
you guys are full of fucking shit.
All of the comments that I usually get are pretty nice, but there was one
Kevin
after
Hart
my,
is a fucking saint.
There was one with my Paul Thomas Anderson kind of rant. And Waffest was where this guy was just basically like taking me to task for not like it, or for my, he said I was just like going on and on. It was just nonsense and drivel.
Right.
And I almost got like really happy and excited because I've always been under the school of thought that if nobody's reacting, then you're doing it wrong. But if they're reacting positively or negatively, then you're striking some kind of a chord.
Sure.
So this, when I saw a negative, I'm just like, finally, so I'm like, this mask of civility is gone. Yeah. It's fine. If you disagree with me or any of this shit that I say on this show or in my columns, voice your opinion. I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great. I love hearing different thoughts. I'll probably just make fun of your opinion, though.
we get trolled. So Rich isn't to say that guy was trolling, but we get trolled so rarely that when it does happen, it's like, oh, right, this is the internet. Like, we're in kind of a bubble.
Yeah.
And so I have to say, like, well, I guess that's good. We got out there to somebody. And luckily, we have this great community that self-regulates. And like
they sure do.
Yeah, they're so quick
to really good.
Defend and pounce.
It's like what should we call it? Tommy Lee Jones with that thing that tightens around people's noses. If somebody's just like,
way to bring it back to like, NBK.
Yeah, it's like what Adam said was bullshit. Somebody's just like, you motherfucker. they take like that commenter and then they like put the thing. He's just like, I will fucking squeeze your nose.
All right. Thank you guys very much for listening. Adam, last words.
Who's got it? Who needs it? We're gonna make this work.